So the average score was boosted by someplace around 12 points or thereabout. Class average turned out to be 80, just about even. If you notice on the right-hand column outside, it gives you your current status grade-wise. So that's the cumulative effect of the exam. There are, again, multiple exam copies, so the easiest way for you to go over your exam is to come to my office and go over your particular slice of the world in terms of the exam. Okay. I think the top score was someplace about 105. There were a handful of people over 100. And the bottom score was someplace less than 60. I don't remember. In the 50s, possibly. As it turns out, you're already preparing for the final exam, since half the final exam will be based on the material you took the test on. So I know that what happens is your brain gets all crunched down at the end, and so we've already begun preparing for the final. Yes?
No, sorry.
Just take your clothes off. Are you done? So the rest of the show is later. So basically, the next exam should be the easiest of all the exams. Do not take that as, I don't have to study. Take that as, now I can make up some points. Okay. So it should be the easier exam because the material, you're starting off at a very low level in analogy and building you up. So the stuff is, once you get it, it's not too bad. It takes a lot of time to develop the concept of it so you don't get as much material to test on. So that's a little easier. There'll still be a range of 105 down to 50 some, but still a bit more. Okay. Specific required immunity, we're talking about donated cells. And the first thing we see there is it's in breast milk, so therefore breast milk has both natural passive antibodies. Natural adoptive. Now these cells, once they're in the baby, they will cross the gut because the nucleus of the gut is immature, so about 6 months of age. So there will not be any enzymatic attack or pH problems for that cell. Artificial adoptive would be donated stem cells. Stem cells, like you will see, are the mother of all the cells in the bloodstream. Red blood cells, platelets, eosinophils, basophils, we'll give you the list later, but everything in the bloodstream is coming from a stem cell. And importantly, stem cells come from stem cells. So when you donate stem cells to an individual, that will reconstitute their entire immune system. Now there are advantages and disadvantages. That obviously advantages if you're getting a new set of workers in your body to protect you. The disadvantage is, the person must be in a setting where they will accept those cells. And to do that, we destroy their own immune system. Now, they've already got some problem with their immune system, but we will finish the job. And so we'll destroy their entire immune system to avoid host versus graft reaction, so that they are not capable of attacking those donated cells. Now, we do this with chemotherapy. We'll get that subsequent in the classes. We use anti-lymphocyte serum, and so we give them antibodies to their own lymphocytes, which will then destroy their lymphocytes. And we also irradiate the individual. So we destroy all the cells of the body that go to the immune system and a few others along the way. So it's rather a shock to the body to go through this process. Once we have them as an empty vessel, as it were, they are extremely susceptible to infection at this point. So we have to be careful. And then we give them somebody else's immune system. Hopefully, it will be a good match. We'll talk about tissue type a little later in this course. If it's a good match, then the grafted cells, the donated stem cells, will not attack the host. That's another problem we have with this procedure. Graft versus host. Unlike giving a heart transplant, the heart cannot attack the patient. You only worry about host versus graft reaction. Patient rejected in the heart. But in this setting, not only do we have that consideration, graft versus host, but we also have host versus graft, and we also have graft versus host. So if we don't match it right, the patient will be destroyed. destroyed by the domain itself. When we do this, we can give them additional treatment. Interleukin 3, we'll talk about that in due course, but a cytokine, a lymphokine. Interleukin 3 will stimulate the stem cell to divide. This was first used in any meaningful way when you were probably in grade school or so, sixth grade, fifth grade, fourth grade. There was a nuclear meltdown in the former Soviet Union, so-called Chernobyl. And they had to, it's still a hot spot today. It's still a nuclear problem. So there's a concomitant pollution of the environment and people getting cancers and, you know, that all continued. But what they did initially was coat the entire reactor with cement. They did this with helicopters dumping cement, tons and tons and tons of this sort of, like an ice cream cone, just covered it all up. The helicopter pilots were exposed to massive doses of radiation. They developed radiation sickness. Signs of radiation sickness usually are loss of integrity of membranes. And so they were bleeding out their orifices, anal openings, their nose, their mouth, their eyes. That's a typical process in terms of one of the things that happens with heavy dose of radiation, radiation sickness, as it's called. And so it was assumed by the Russians at the time that their immune system was completely destroyed. And so they gave them the stem cells with IL-3, first one of the early uses of IL-3. The problem was their immune system wasn't completely destroyed. And so the IL-3 helped the graft grow, but it also helped return to their own immune system. Had they been given IL-3 alone, they might have made it. Almost all of them died. They died of host versus graft reaction. So we have to be very careful about that. A little bit of the immune system left behind may be sufficient to trigger problems. And it's because we give the interleukin-3. Now, there's many permutations on this. One easy one is shown here. Here we have a patient on the upper left-hand side here, and we are going to irradiate them and use chemotherapy and so on, destroy their immune system for whatever problem they might have. When we take out their stem cells, store them, and put them back into the patient again. So they've rescued themselves, so to speak, like donating blood to yourself. You donate before the surgery, and then after surgery you get your unit of blood back. This is the same basic concept. So this is not going to have any problem with host versus graft or graft versus host. Now, modifications of this have been tried, but not very successful. If a person has leukemia, for example, prior to freezing in this step one here, what we do is we try to remove all of the aberrant cells. We have a good clear surface marker. We can use what's called a cell sorter. We can actually sort out the cells that we don't want to go back in the patient. The problem is the markers are not always perfect, and we sometimes inject back some of the aberrant cells and we have a recurrence of the problem, so it's not necessarily a foolproof idea by any means. But this is one permutation of the idea of using the bone marrow transplant. This would be autologous, meaning self. Now, this will be a real just quick, we'll run through this because you have this in anatomy, and this is a placeholder, so you look at it later and review it. Organs and cells of the immune system. We know we have tonsils and lymph nodes and spleen and virus factors and so on. We'll talk about these in due course. Thymus is located right about where your tire knocks, the tire thereabouts. And in the human, the thymus declines in size and function someplace beginning around age 5, by the time you are as old and decrepit as you all are, in your early 20s for the most part, is gone. It's just diffuse tissue. The thymus is a location where T cells become educated. They, prior to that, they are lymphoid cells, and they become T cell lymphocytes under the influence of local climbing cell signals. So it's a processing center for T cell lymphocytes. A similar processing center is associated with B cells, although it's much more diffuse. Initially, we thought it was only associated with virus patches, and so we call it gut-associated lymphoid tissue that will process lymphoid cells and become B cells. Later, we found it's really associated with the entire mucosal membranes, and so nasal passages and tonsils and all that kind of stuff, ocular components, and so we call it mucosal. were gone from God's associated lymphoid tissue to God's, which is a more narrow area where we process lymphoid cells and some B cells, to a broader area called MALT, mucosal associated lymphoid tissue. So we have to process these cells, mature these cells. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But there's a location for this to occur. We also have processing of B cells and lymphoid cells that are in the skin, all that cutaneous associated lymphoid tissue or CALT. We'll show you that. Primary lymphoid structures again, thymus, B cells are processed. We have the B cell lymphocytes being processed in MALT, mucosal associated lymphoid tissue, cutaneous associated lymphoid tissue. All of this is referred to as being, in a collective sense, areas where B cells are processed from lymphoid cells to B cell lymphocytes are called bursa equivalent tissue. The bursa is a discrete structure associated with birds. It's near the cloacal opening of a bird. A cloaca is a combined fecal urinary system. Romans used that to describe their initial sewage system, was called the cloaca. That's the term for excrement in animals as well, in birds. So it's combined fecal urinary system. That's why birds always seem like they have diarrhea. A bird flies over your car on the windshield, a cow can fly with denture cough. They don't have a combined fecal urinary system. So it's near the cloacal opening, a combined fecal urinary system of birds. We see a discrete structure, and if we remove this early on in the life of the bird, then they have no B cells. So we can clearly relate that. We hope to find something like that in humans. As it turns out, it's much more diffuse. So there is no single place, there are many places. The thymus, again, we're just going to scan through this and see a little bit about it. Here's the thymus. We have the nurse cells, which are used to help mature the lymphoid cells to become T cell lymphocytes. And of course, they have to get in and out. So we have blood vessels going in and out. We have the dividing cells near the nerve cells. These are the ones that are maturing, becoming functional T cell lymphocytes. We also have this strange cell called the interdigitation dendritic cell, the dendritic cell. So this is sort of like a French film, not a movie, but a film. And there's a character in the first scene that's got a red hat on. And they walk by, and nobody says where they are, they're just there. And a few minutes later in the film, you see this guy in the red hat again. And throughout the entire movie, who is this guy in the red hat? They never mention him. In the very end, you find out whoever that is. Well, that's what this dendritic cell is. It pops up all the time, and we're just now learning who this guy in the red hat is. And here we see this dendritic cell. It's part of this so-called matrix there of the thymus. But we'll see it in other places as well. If we look at a cross-section of the infants, thymus, we see lots of areas that are sort of dark here. These are areas of rapidly growing cells. We call them germinal centers. This is where we're seeing lots of activity. These are longitudinal sections of blood vessels here and cross-sections of around one. So there's lots of blood vessels going throughout this structure. Very active, in and out, in and out, in and out. Take a look at an adult, this is the person in their 20s and older, you see a lot of areas which are not well activated. You see areas where there used to be a lot of activity, but now of course cells are not even staying on the slide. And you see a lot of infiltration of adipose tissue, that is fat tissue. This fatty infiltrate is typical of structures that are no longer functioning normal, or at least not doing what they were doing before. We see fatty cells infiltrated in liver cells and their cirrhosis and so on. This is a typical sign that we see when an organ is losing function. So basically, by the time you're in your 20s, it's not functioning very well. And it's a significant decline after the age of about 5. In comparison with other animals, however, guinea pigs, rabbits, rats, mice, they have all of the 90% of their functioning of the thymus occurs before they're even born. And so when they're born, it's already losing function. So in one sense, we have a longer maturation period than many other mammals. But nonetheless, it starts not working after a while. So that means that T-cells are made early on in life. And we used to say all of your T-cells are made early on in life. But then we do have those settings where we do, as we mentioned a moment ago, a stem cell transplant. We give you stem cells, which give rise to a variety of cells, including lymphoid cells. So how is it possible in a stem cell transplant for a person that does not have a thymus, they're 47 years old or whatever, the thymus is not functioning much at all, how is it possible then to convert lymphoid cells into T-cell lymphocytes? The answer is a little black box. We don't know the correct answer. We call them extrathymic processing sites. Someplace outside the thymus that's still working. We have not found it in humans. We have found it in other animals. So we're suspicious that it's around, but we haven't found it. But we have certainly direct evidence in terms of the processing of lymphoid cells into T cells with the transplant. So we have also for B cell processing, mucosal associated lymphoid tissue or MALT. And you can see that we have Peyer's patches involved, also parts of the tongue area, and we also have the consulate area. So when we're converting a lot of cells from lymphoid cells to B cells, we have that occurring there. And then we have Peyer's patches with the so-called M cells involved at the bottom of this strip of the jaw, and we see this area around the cochlea, can you tell that? And then when we see the areas where they're dividing greatly, it's called the germinal center. And if we come in contact with antigen and it stimulates the body, that's called a primary follicle. So the primary follicle that becomes the germinal center. Cutaneous associated lymphoid tissue or cult. And then we have the epidermis and the dermis layer. And we have these funny cells again, these Langerhans cells. And they become veiled cells in the bloodstream, and then they become, in the lymph node itself, this invading dendritic cell. This is the guy in the red hat. Notice it's got different names, because it's discovered at different times when we didn't know there was a relationship between the cells. So we have Langerhans cells becoming veiled cells, becoming these dendritic cells. As we'll see, this is part of antigen processing, where we see these cells in the skin. So when we take that DNA gun, so to speak, it's got the gold pellets with the DNA on it, and we inject it into the skin, it is this area that receives that particular DNA, inserts it into a cell, and starts producing the antigen, and that will actually stimulate a new response in your skin. You realize that was possible, but it is. That's this cutaneous associated lymphoid tissue that's involved in that process. Secondary lymphoid organs are spleen and lymph nodes. This is where those process cells, the T cells and B cells, go after they graduate from the processing process. After they become educated in the spleen and lymph nodes, they become mature, differentiated from a lymphoid cell to a B cell or a T cell. The B cells go to the spleen and lymph nodes, and they set up, given the specific architecture, they set up a location, home. In the spleen and the lymph node. And they will stay there for the rest of their functional life. So B cells that are in the bloodstream are in transit from where they were graduated from, where they were processed, where they were differentiated at, and they are moving to the spleen and lymph node. So the levels of B cells in the bloodstream are just sort of transient cells. They're not out there functioning. T cells, on the other hand, will go to the spleen and lymph node, again to specific locations. And from there, they will then spread throughout the body. They're always recirculating. So B cells stay at home, T cells recirculate. If we look at the structures, again, we know this stuff in anatomy a couple of times ago. But here we have the red follicle and the white follicle, sometimes it's referred to. So we're looking for these primary follicles. Okay, this is where things are happening. Cross-section, you can see this darkened area that is follicle. This is a blood vessel here. Okay. So what's happening here is an antigen has presented itself and it's stimulated cells to divide. We're making antibody right here in the tissue. lymph nodes. You can see where they are. They're associated with breast tissue. They're also associated with a variety of other tissues and the entire lymph system of moving things around. So we have a lymph node. Again, this is a pretty drawing of it, but again, we've got cortex, paracortex, medulla. We have the blood vessels going in and out. We have the lymph system going in and out. There you can see a little bit better. You can see that we have germinal centers, and we have B cells and T cells. There's a specific arrangement of B cells and T cells. T cells are going to be on the outside, B cells on the inside. We have a specific arrangement. If a patient had a problem during fetal development and they did not develop a thymus, then they have no place to process lymphoid cells or T cells, and therefore they have no T cells. If you do a lymph node biopsy on such a patient, by the way, that's called a DeGeorge patient, DeGeorge, DeGeorge patient, then there would be no cells where the T cells are supposed to be. Likewise, if we have a patient that has no B cells, for example, a Bruton's patient, B-R-U-T-O-N-S, Bruton's patient, we do a lymph node biopsy on that patient, and we can find no B cells in the location where they should be. So we can use lymph node biopsies to get a handle on what's happening relative to very gross defects, the lack of T or B cells in the patient. Cells in the immune system, these are stem cells giving rise to things. It's important to realize that stem cells give rise to stem cells and all the other cells in the immune system. During fetal development, during embryological development, these stem cells are coming from the yolk sac. As you sit in the chair this morning, they're coming from the bone marrow. This is an initial placement, the initial development in the embryonic system, but it's also part of an ongoing replacement. All the cells in the bloodstream have a half-life. They last for a certain period of time. Some last for a matter of a few hours, others will last for months or years. But they constantly need to be replaced. If we don't replace them, then we have a problem. If we have a drug allergy, let's say with a drug allergy that results in destruction of stem cells, maybe chlorinfenicol. Chlorinfenicol results in aplastic anemia. No cells in the bloodstream. What happened? It destroyed the stem cells of the patient. So keep this in mind that this is an ongoing replacement as well as the original development of the yolk sac and the embryonic development. We can see this process unfolding. If we look at the embryological development and there's a problem in the embryological development, then we have an immunodeficiency. I gave you just two a moment ago, but there's more we'll give you, the DeGeorge and the problem with T cells, because of the thymus. Bruton is a problem with B cell production. One doesn't have T cell responses, the other doesn't have B cells or antibody responses. So we'll look at specific immunodeficiencies. We use these as one of the early Nobel Prize winners in immunology called it experiments of nature. A typical experiment in the lab is one style experiment is called a knockout. Knockout is we take that part out, we don't know what it does, and we see what happens. An analogy in a car, we don't know what the battery does. So we take the battery out and the car doesn't start. But if we have a car that's running and we take the battery out, it continues to run. So we have to figure out if that's only needed in the starting part, if not needed in the running part. That kind of thing. A knockout. But we have these natural experiments of nature, these natural knockouts, when patients have a deficiency and they don't produce T cells or B cells or whatever. That would be an embryological problem if born with it. Okay? On the other hand, some patients develop problems that they didn't have when they were first born. They develop leukemia or lymphoma. In which case, then we can analyze what their problem is on an ongoing basis. Okay? So the first one, the immunodeficiency by taking the car battery out and then trying to start the car. The other was the ongoing replacement. We can look at the number of cells, the type of cells, T cells and B cells. Where are they? Are they in the lymph nodes or not? What are the numbers we're looking at? What are we looking at numbers in the bloodstream or numbers in the in the area of biopsy. So we're looking at the various aspects to get a sense of it. And we also look at deficiencies in inflammation, as we'll see. Inflammation, redness, swelling, heat, and pain. This is a sign that we're having an immune response. But if you have deficiencies, then you'll have specific problems that are resulting in a lack of an appropriate immune response. Inflammation, you can think of as having a picnic. You have a successful picnic, you can eat a hot dog, you can eat a bun, you can eat the mustard, you can eat the ketchup, and so on. And if a patient doesn't have the hot dog, then there's something wrong with the picnic. But if they have the hot dog with some of the buns, there's something wrong with the picnic, and so on. So you think of this inflammation as a collection of events with a variety of different participants, and all you need is one of those participants not to be there, and we have a problem with the overall event. So we need to then sort of use a knockout approach. We'll see what happens to a patient in their inflammation if they don't have this problem. This part of the that part. Again, not to memorize it, but I want you to know these numbers I'll give them to you. But we do have a pretty good idea of what we expect to find in the bloodstream in terms of the number of red blood cells, the number of platelets, various kinds of white blood cells, from neutrophils, on down to basophils. Remember, all of these cells, red blood cells, platelets, neutrophils, lymphocytes, macrophages, which would be the monocytes, eosinophils, and basophils. All of these cells are coming from stem cells. You should already have an idea of what they all do. Okay. And we'll sort of elucidate some of those as we go through it. Again, as part of what we've done in the album. Well, this looks like a very, very busy slide, but it's really a neat slide. The first thing I want you to recognize is there are lots of different cells at different stages. The second thing I want you to realize is that there are little lines with things on them. Don't worry about the things. Those are cell signals. And the ones they want you to know about will be coming in course. So let's take a look at this. In this part right here, we have an unidentified cell that you can label as a stem cell. And the stem cell can do cell renewal. So a stem cell can rise to have a stem cell. That's a good thing. That's the essence of a bone marrow transplant. We give you a little bit, and it makes more. We have two major bifurcations early in the differentiation process, in the specialization process. And one is we make a myeloid cell, and from this myeloid cell, we make then several intermediate cells, each one receiving different cell signals. You notice many of these are listed as an IL, an IL-3 there, an IL-6, an IL-5, an IL-9. That's an interleukin. An interleukin is a cytokine, a cell signal. Most of these are coming from T cells, but they can come from other cells as well. So these cells are receiving a signal. And that means that they have a signal receptor site on their surface. And so we see that this myeloid cell receives a certain signal, and it then we have the production of a granulocyte monocyte progenitor, meaning an intermediate cell. And that will then become neutrophils, which we know them to be polymorphic neutrophil cells, or phagocytic cells, monocytes, which then differentiate into macrophage, another phagocytic cell. And notice the dotted line that we're working on, under construction in terms of concept, dendritic cells, the guys in the red hats again. Okay. We're not sure whether they come from monocytes or they come directly from this earlier cell. There's a little question mark there. Then we have the intermediate cell, the progenitor cell, or eosinophils. And then we have the eosinophil, we have basophils, and basophil progenitor, notice that it becomes a mast cell and a basophil. Mast cells are in the tissue, basophils are in the bloodstream. They both are the same kind of cell. Both are very pharmacologically active. They have many, many different mediators inside them. For example, now, just remember, there's histamine in there. And so when mast cells release histamine, they're going to have an effect on the tissue around them. As you know, histamine, for example, if it's released a lot of it systemically throughout the body, it's going to be a vasodilator. It's going to cause blood pressure to drop. It's also going to cause the bronchial areas to contract. So it contracts the bronchial areas. If we have this happening systemically, as we might in an allergic reaction of what we call as type 1, Roman numeral 1, type 1 hypersensitivity. You may have heard of it as anaphylactic or immediate hypersensitivity. That involves mast cells releasing many mediators, including histamine. Histamine being released in massive amounts throughout the body systemically, causing the blood vessel to dilate, the patient's blood pressure drops. Within 20 minutes to an hour, they could be dead if we don't do something about it. And then we also have congestion occurring in the lungs. They have difficulty breathing. It's increased secretion, so we have more mucus inside the bronchial areas, and we are contracting them down. That makes it difficult to breathe. So these are the effects of histamine on a systemic basis. Basophils are in the bloodstream. There can be basophilic reactions, but they're relatively rare in the narrow situations that occur. We'll talk about them in allergic reactions. The mast cells are primarily, as we see them, involved in allergic reactions. Mast cells are also involved in a protective immune response against multicellular parasites, roundworms, flatworms, those kinds of things. We don't see too many of those in the United States, so we don't see that kind of the good side. All we see is the evil twin brother causing allergic reaction type 1, hypersensitivity. But on a worldwide basis, we certainly see lots and lots of parasitic infections. We may see occasional Ascaris infections. Anybody have parasitic? Ascaris, they're sort of like the males and females are different lengths, but they run anywhere from about 5 inches up to maybe 11 inches or so. It's sort of like an earthworm, roughly in diameter, a little smaller than an earthworm, pointed at both ends, and they migrate between the lungs and the intestinal tract. So that means they come up into the throat, and they often do that at night. So if you're ever working in a hospital and you get called in the emergency room area, you may see this, particularly at night, and it sort of looks like something on an alien. Okay? Because they have a young child with a Ascaris infection, and they're choking on these worms, and they have to reach in and really pull them out by the handful and fill up jars. Really weird. So we see those kind of things. We see pinworms on occasion. You know. So we don't see, of the range of 100 different parasitic infections, we see maybe 5 in the United States. So it's not too common. Worldwide, certainly a different situation. But our protective immune response to these is, in fact, mast cells releasing their mediators. And one of the mediators that mast cells can produce, both in a type 1 hypersensitivity, as well as protective against multicellular parasites, is a chemical signal, a chemotactic factor, chemical signal that will attract eosinophils. So the eosinophils you see here is being attracted to where the mast cells are releasing the signal. On the protective side, eosinophils will release a variety of mediators on their own, and they will isolate and destroy the parasitic organism. That's good news. It's also good news if a person is having an anaphylactic shock reaction, because they will release mediators that will neutralize the mediators coming from mast cells. It's a balancing act, a yin and yang thing. One of the mediators, for example, that's been released, one of the signals coming out of the eosinophil, is histamine ACE, an enzyme that will specifically destroy histamine. So you can see that the patient is now going to be saved. And so the mast cell that is releasing the histamine that's causing the bronchial contraction and the violation of blood vessels and life-threatening situations with a type 1 hypersensitivity, that person is going to be saved, hopefully, because one of the mediators that's going to be coming from the mast cell is a chemotactic factor that's going to attract the eosinophils that is going to put out the fire. So we have this balancing act. So a patient who has a history of type 1 allergies, which would mean like hay fever, penicillin allergies, bee sting allergies, and so on, they will have increased levels of eosinophils in their bloodstream. And the name for that is called eosinophilia. So a patient with elevated eosinophils, higher than the normal number, that's an indication that they either have a parasitic infection, possible but unlikely, or that they have a type 1 hypersensitivity history, that's quite likely. So you might say, well then, why doesn't that excess eosinophils save the person? Why do they risk to die? For reasons that we don't always understand, a patient may have a decline in the number of eosinophils on the same time that they need them. So maybe a virus wipes them out, maybe there's some hiccup in the process of making the eosinophils that we're not aware of. And so that particular day, the 37th time that they were exposed to their problem, there's not enough eosinophils to correct and they die. We won't know what that time is. It could be their very first allergic reaction, or it could be their 37th allergic reaction. We have no way of knowing at this point in time. So if a person has a history of a type 1 allergy, we must take it seriously. We must assume, worst case scenario, we must get into a hospital soon. Okay? Now, they can also be instructed to have the EpiPens and so on, because one of the things we can do is give epinephrine, which will then accelerate the movement of blood through the bloodstream and try to counteract that dilation effect. You give them to the hospital, we're going to give them antihistamines and so on. We're going to try to contain it. But we have that 20 minutes to an hour to do it. And if you're 40 minutes from the hospital, you've got to get moving right away. So it's one of those things where early action, even though 37 times out of 38 times it was not necessary, they made it to the hospital and didn't need any help. That one time that you don't go is the time that they die. So we don't know which one it's going to be, so we have to take them all seriously. So that's basophils, mast cells, and they will release mediators, and eosinophils will try to neutralize those mediators. We also have the megakaryocyte, which gives rise to the platelets. And we have the erythroid cell, which has a nucleus, to becoming an erythrocyte, which does not have a nucleus, and you've got all that kind of stuff already. So basically, this is what's happening with this side of the system. This is what's happening from yolk sac-based stem cells embryologically, or stem cells found in the bone marrow, if we're talking about something that's ongoing replacement. On the top part, we have the lymphoid supply. The lymphoid cells have arrived. We have several different ones. Notice that we have one dotted line. I'm not exactly certain where it fits into the system. These are NK cells, or natural killers. As you'll see, they lack the normal expected surface markers to identify them as T cell lymphocytes. But they function like killer T cells, but they are not killer T cells. They are natural killer cells. So they're sort of on their little rogue kind of cells, probably an evolutionary offshoot and so on. But they do exist. Because they lack the surface markers, we often call them null cells, N-U-L-L. They lack the normal markers that we use to identify them as T cells. They function like T cells. Then we have the system that leads to the development of B cell lymphocytes, and we have a system that leads to the development of T cell lymphocytes. And you see that part of this is going to process into the thymus. Likewise, the B cell perimeter part of it is going through the burst and equivalent tissue. We have one kind of B cell, a resting B cell, and notice on its surface are structural equivalents to antibodies. We typically think antibody is something we expect to find in the bloodstream as a protein by itself. And we'll see, it's probably more likely part of a surface receptor-like site system that sometimes gets shed. And so it's surface receptor sites we see it functioning on its almost normal basis. It's what sloughs off later is sort of an evolutionary new idea. And so we have these surface receptor sites which are essentially antibodies. And they're on the surface of the B cell. And they will then interact with the antigen in the splenial lymph node, be stimulated to divide, become a memory B cell, and a plasma cell that's actually secreting antibodies. All of this is occurring in the splenial lymph node. So that's why your lymph nodes swell up, not because the organism is growing in there, but because B cells are triggered to divide and it's producing antibodies. It's a good sign. So if you have a patient, if it's an AIDS patient, and they're not getting enough help from their T cells, and therefore they're getting very little antibody production as a result of that. I mean, there's not much swelling in the lymph node, people are very sick. Some students, some common everyday people think that the swelling in the lymph nodes or in the back of their throats and the tonsils, all that swelling is the organism growing in there. No, that's your immune response. Lymphoproliferation is all the immune response. The T cells, we have various functional subpopulations. Here we're showing just two of the several. We have cytotoxic T cells, TCs. These cytotoxic or killer T cells are under much more control than the natural killer cells, but they can also function as a way of killing cells. We have the helper T cells that will help you have an immune response. They will help T cells respond, but they'll also help B cells respond. As it turns out, about 90% of all the antigens that your B cells come in contact with, about 90%, require you to also have T helper cell function. So you need T helpers for 90% of the antibodies. That means 10% of the antibodies can be produced without T cell helpers. So an AIDS patient that doesn't have any of these cells, T helpers are lost, is going to have complete problems in making T cell responses, but they'll have only 10% of the targets that they respond to. Now, an interesting balancing act of nature, if we look at the total antibody in the bloodstream of an AIDS patient, it's going to be near normal. So what they do is they overproduce to the 10% targets that they can. So E. coli is the wall over there, and there's 100 possible antigen targets out there. The AIDS patients are only responding to 10% of them. But they over-respond, in a sense, so you have a larger amount, you know, 10 than you'd expect. And the total amount of immunoglobulin does not drop off, like you might expect, because there's overcompensation. So these are the various cells. Now, seeing like this, two things we need to take away from this. First off, if we have a congenital problem of some sort, then we don't have the proper processing of these early cells. Now, if that proper processing results in a lack of, let's say, red blood cells, then we have a miscarriage. The life form cannot sustain itself. And so that embryo that does not develop. So if we have that kind of major deficit, we can't survive it. On the other hand, if you have a problem developing the lymphoid system, and you don't have the right receptor sites, or you're not getting the right signals produced, you don't progress in the next stage, then you're born without B cells or you're born without T cells. And those would be the knockout experiments that we'll talk about, for example, the George being without T cells and the Cruzens without T cells. On the other hand, during ongoing replacement, a person may have a leukemia, and that may be a T cell leukemia or a B cell leukemia. And what's happening is it's not progressing in the next stage. You can think of this as an assembly line. And although we show only a few spots along the line, there's many, many spots, many, many stages. And what happens then is that we see immature lymphocytes in the bloodstream of the patient. Those immature lymphocytes can be identified using monoclonal antibodies, very specific antibodies called monoclonal. These monoclonal antibodies, that's MAB we call them, these very specific antibodies, serologically used as a reagent, can identify what particular stage you are in. We can match that stage with a specific chemotherapy. For example, let's make the numbers up, but St. Jude has a lot of different protocols. So let's say we use St. Jude protocol number 6, and it was only 50% effective. And now we use the monoclonal antibody system to specifically identify your specific kind of leukemia. We can now match that up with protocol number 6, and now maybe we're 95% successful when we match it properly, and we also realize that we have a bunch that we don't have a treatment for at all. Before they were all lumped together, and we couldn't distinguish them. But now we find that the treatment only works for a subcategory, which we can specifically identify using these markers. So that's good news, bad news. Good news if we have the right marker match for the protocol. Bad news if we realize that we don't have treatment for it. But this is part of the research as well. So you can have ongoing replacement problems with T cells and B cells. Now when you have that, as you might expect, in your understanding of the concept of homeostasis and so on, the body will try to push more cells down the line, not giving you an end product. Okay? You have an immature lymphocyte, T cell or B cell, and it's not progressing to the next stage, and so therefore you're not getting the end product. So there's more and more stem cells that are going to be shunted down this rabbit hole. So we have increasing numbers of the immature lymphocyte in the bloodstream. At the same time, this patient is going to have a decline in the number of problems. myeloid cells in the system because everything's going up this way, through the lymphoid system. And so the patient's going to present not with leukemia per se, but they're going to have problems with their clotting time, long clotting time. You need a platelet count. You need a low platelet count. We talk about their physical signs and symptoms. They have lots of bruises. They bang themselves a little bit to get blood into the tissue, a lot more than you'd expect. So they have these hemorrhaging in the tissue, the hematoma, because they're not able to stop even the small capillary bleeds. They may also be anemic and tired all the time. They're not producing enough red blood cells. Their red blood cells are pretty low. So initially, when they give them packed red blood cells and platelet concentrates to make them feel better and function better, but the main problem is up here. Notice the interconnectedness of all of this. It makes sense then when the patient complains of bruising, of tiredness, etc. And when we get the clinical results of low red blood cells and low platelets, even though they have a problem up here in leukemia. Sometimes we're able to shut down this rat hole. We still don't get the end product, but the system goes back online a little bit because we were able to stop that immature system from working. And that puts then a normal balance coming down to the myeloid cell line, and then they have normal levels of platelets, they develop normal red blood cells, they feel a whole lot better, they're functioning a whole lot better. We still haven't solved the problem with leukemia, but we're working on it. So you need to understand how this works as an ongoing development, as well as an ongoing replacement. Initial development, ongoing replacement. Immune system in action. We want to look at phagocytosis. We want to look at the concept of inflammation. We want to look in some detail of humoral immunity, B cells making plasma, plasma-causing antibody, and as well as other components of the bloodstream, such as the complement system. And then we want to look at cell-mediated immunity. So phagocytosis. First thing we want to notice is we have a two-cell system. Neutrophils and neutrophils, which are TMNs, and macrophages. So we have a two-cell system. So right away, I want you to start thinking about parallel worlds. We have an antibody system, and we have a lymphokine system. We have a B-cell making antibody, we have T-cell making lymphokine. We have two kinds of phagocytic cells. Macrophages can also function as antigen-presenting cells, APCs. This has to do with how we initiate the immune response. So in addition to being phagocytic cells, macrophages can also play a second role in initiating immune response. Our first line of defense begins in minutes. TMNs are involved. TMNs have a very short half-life. In a matter of hours. And we can use that to our advantage to understand what's going on in the patient. By saying that PMNs have a half-life in a matter of hours, and we know that PMN is coming from the function of the stem cell, we get sort of an immediate feedback of how well the stem cells are doing. The PMNs that are protecting you as you're sitting in the chair right now were developed last night in the middle of the night while you were hopefully asleep. The ones that you are working right now with, you're developing right now, are probably where I'm on my study. But nonetheless, we have this constant. They were still making, even while you're up studying, you were still making. So what happens is, what happens if at 3 o'clock in the morning, you had a shutdown, and you no longer were making any more stem cells functioning? The stem cells stop functioning. The first cell that you're going to notice a deficiency in is in the neutrophil. So if we, for example, are pulse irradiating patient because they have a cancer, and the radiation works on rapidly growing cells, that's its selective toxicity, if you want to think of it that way. So that means the patient's hair falls out, and that means the lining of the gut is affected, and they get nauseous and so on. All of that is because those are areas of rapidly growing cells. Well, stem cells are rapidly growing. So the first cell of all the cells in the bloodstream, you're going to notice not functioning normally after a pulse of radiation, are going to be the neutrophils. They're going to drop the number. We call that a neutropenia. Neutropenia is the dropping of the number of neutrophils. So a neutropenia. And so that's to be expected. But we also have ways of countering that. We can give you some lubricants and so on that will bring your neutrophils back online. That's why we give you a pulse radiation. We don't put you on radiation for 24 hours a day for 7 weeks. Okay. You would not survive it. We just give you radiation reversed. Or we give you chemotherapy reversed. And then we let you recover in another version. Because it shuts down things other than simply the target tumor, shuts down the stem cell development. So this half-life, being very short, is the first one that you can notice the deficiency of stem cell function. So if a patient would have an allergic reaction to clinical and a stem cell would be destroyed, the first cell that we notice going wrong are PMN. It's a sentinel cell. So it's a, besides being this important phagocytic cell, it's a sentinel cell that tells us that the canary in the mine shafts in 1880 miners. If the canaries in, the canaries would die because they're very sensitive to carbon monoxide. They would be, they are going to get next, so they have to get out of the mine. The same thing here. We're using PMN as a sentinel to indicate the health of the stem cell system. They are in cells, they're not capable of further division. And we have a picture of the multilobar nucleus and so on. Notice we have a little structure here called a phagosome. That's going to be where we have the destruction of the target organisms when it evolves. Now we have innate immunity. That is, we have phagocytic cells evolving things, but it's a very, very low efficiency. So if a patient didn't have any B cell response at all, or very low B cell response, maybe an AIDS patient, not making my antibody, no T cell response, you still have those phagocytic cells, and they will bump into slowly evolved organisms. It's not a very efficient system, but it is in existence. Do they have something? Yes, they have something. No. So we have an innate immunity mechanism. That would be just phagocytic cells working alone without any help. But we also have ways of helping them. We have acute inflammation. Acute inflammation is an alarm system. It will activate the polymorph inhibitor cells. It will focus their attack. To do that, we need humoral immunity in the form of antibody coming from B cells that became plasma cells that secreted antibody. The B cells become the plasma cells that secrete antibody. And we have this unusual system of proteins discovered initially by the French called the complement system. Complement system is 11 different proteins that work in a sequence. It's a little bit like a clotting system. We have inactive things that become activated that then activate something else and so on. It's called a cascade. So we have a cascade reaction. And that will be important, and we'll talk about that in a moment or two. Our second line of defense is going to be macrophages. They have a half-life of days or even months and years. They kick in after 2 to 4 days. So our first line of defense begins in minutes and lasts for 2 to 4 days. Our second line of defense begins in 2 to 4 days and can last 2 months or years if necessary. This is called chronic inflammation. It's a cell-mediated immunity that's T cells releasing lymphocytes. So we have a dual system again. One is antibody-based, PMNs, acute inflammation. The other one is T-cell based, lymphokines, chronic inflammation. We see macrophage involved. So we have two different kinds of phagocytic cells under two different control systems, but they all result in inflammation. Now, the macrophage population that you have, as again, you know, from AMP, you have circulating macrophage, we call them free, and they're coming in and out of the lymph node spleen. And they're found in the bloodstream. So a capillary breaks and they're going to be jumping right to the spot. On the other hand, we have fixed macrophage, part of the reticular endothelial system. These are macrophages that are associated with a specific tissue. They do not move around. They stay right where they're put. you go by a variety of different names because they were named by different people, and everybody wants to discover something and name it after themselves, so they have different names. Notice it is the reticular endothelial system, RES. It is not the RES system. I point that out only to you for the purposes that you're aware of it, so that when you talk about such things, physicians will understand what you're talking about and not think that you don't know what you're talking about. It's sort of like the newscast was talking about a boxer who has AIDS, and he says he has the HIV virus, also known as the human immunodeficiency virus. So right away, someone's like, with HIV virus, maybe they don't know what they're talking about. If someone's talking about the RES system, that's the reticular endothelial system, they may not know what they're talking about. Okay, so use it properly, and that'll be better for you. So we have the RES. Again, we get the monocyte, we get right into our macrophage. Notice that our macrophage population, we have a large nuclei there. It's not a multi-node nucleus, it's a nice little round one. And then in the cytoplasm area, we have lots of different kinds of things going on. And we have three stages. It may not be apparent to you, but there are three stages. Here we have a pseudopod. Now, this can occur both on macrophage and PMN. It's shown here on macrophage. Pseudopod. So, it's shown as billowy kind of arms that are really not quite that billowy, but diagrammatically they're shown that way. Pseudopod. False foot. Remember, this is a membrane, so it's moving, it can move in different shapes. It surrounds the organism. And when it surrounds the organism, it creates a phagosome. Now, if you follow that process, the inside of this phagosome was once the outside of the cell. Do you see that? The inside of the phagosome was once the outside of the cell. So that means, although we bring the organism inside the cell, it's not running around free in the cytoplasm. It's still a part. We then have lysosomes. Okay. The lysosome contains a variety of different compounds, including lysozyme that attacks the 1,4 beta linkage from the urine layer, particularly affecting the gram positive organism. So we have lysosome that has a variety of enzymes in there, and it will then merge with this. And when it merges like two bubbles. And it dumps the contents of the lysosome into the phagosome. Again, the contents are not released to the cytoplasm. So we now have a killing zone, and that's called a phagolysosome. So we have pseudopods 1, phagosome 2, lysosome 3, phagolysosome 4. It is in the phagolysosome that we actually have the activation and the killing of the target. Now, some organisms, when they're inside the phagosome, have developed defense mechanisms to get out. And when they do so, they can actually spill the contents of the phagolysosome out into the cytoplasm and kill the phagocytic cell. Staphylococcus aureus is such a cell. So one of the characteristics features of a staph infection is pus formation or suppuration. So we have an abscess and we have all this pus coming out. And the pus is a dead phagocytic cell. How does that happen? Well, one of the mechanisms is that the organism will actually use the enzymes that are in the lysosome, which are now found in the phagolysosome, to release and actually kill the cell. And then the bacteria can get out. Here's an actual photograph. You can see these pseudopods are not these billowy arms, but rather these long fin structures. But nonetheless, they can curve around and they can pull the organisms here in yellow and they can pull them into the cell. Notice the surface of the membrane is rough and bumpy. That's typical of most of your cells. These rough and bumpy pockets then are the receptor sites in this particular cell we have. So where do we find cells in the particular endothelial system? These are fixed macrophage. You can see in the diagram here, sort of the two diagram, but it shows you where they are. One thing to keep in mind is the receptor site for the human immunodeficiency virus, the so-called CD4 marker, the cluster differentiation number 4 that interacts with the glycoprotein 120 and 140 on the surface of the virus. That structure, CD4, is pushed on the helper T cell. but it's also found in macrophages. So all these cells of the particular endothelial system can be infected with HIV, and they are stuck in tissue. So, for example, we're going to have a population of cells in the brain called the microglial cells that can be infected with HIV. Of course, we have the free macrophage here, which are the ones that are coming in out of the lymph node. We have alveolar macrophage in the lungs. We have pleural cavity macrophage. We have splitting macrophage. We have macrophage in the joints, synovial macrophage. The sandial cells in the kidney. Peritoneal cells in the gut. Kupffer cells in the liver. All of these that are phagocytic cells. One type of cell, the particular endothelial system, is not a phagocytic cell, and it's an osteoclast. Osteoclasts basically hollow out the bones so they become lighter. Okay. It can be this cavernous nature, not a solid bone. Less dense bone is lighter, enables you to get up and walk around. We evolved that a couple of years, maybe 150,000 years ago, or maybe 300,000 years ago. You evolved less dense bone. Your Neanderthals and so on had more dense bone, and we evolved beyond that. So basically, we have a lighter bone, which allows you to be more mobile, and to be more mobile sooner. If you were very, very heavy, and your head was very heavy, at age 2 months, you could not lift your head and move around the room and crawl or anything like that. You might have to be 4 or 5 years of age to move around because you didn't have the muscles. So basically, it's a lot of evolutionary advantages. But that hollowing out is an osteoclast. Stage of phagocytosis. Wow. High stage. There's five types of entries on a multiple match. Amazing. So you have five stages. Signal pursuit, surface recognition, injection, digestion. These are five stages. And remember, we have phagocytosis occurring under acute inflammation as well as under chronic inflammation. First situation, we have a signal. The signal in acute inflammation is a complement component. It sets up a gradient, concentration gradient, high concentration of the signal where the organism is, and low concentration away. In order to be the phagocytic cell, the TMN goes up the concentration gradient to find the target. That moving up the gradient is called pursuit. The signal in the case of chronic inflammation is a lymphokine coming from a T cell. And that will attract macrophage. And that also then will be going up the pursuit. Once there, we have surface recognition, which is really nothing more than hydrophilic hydrophobic. Back in the beginning, of course, we talked about oxidizing antibodies and organisms with sugar coating and sugar coating with hydrophilic. And to be a target, we have to be hydrophobic. To be having the antibodies, we have to be hydrophobic. That's what we're talking about. Surface recognition is just relative hydrophobicity. These cells are not distinguishing between self and non-self, and not distinguishing between good bugs and bad bugs, and none of that going on. If it is more hydrophobic, target the organism. If it's more hydrophobic than the phagocytic cell, the involvement occurs. If it's not, the involvement doesn't occur. Simply that. The surface recognition is simply hydrophobic and hydrophobic interaction. Once we have the pseudopods surrounded, the process of creating that phagosome is called ingestion. When we make the phagolysosome, that's called ingestion. Process is identical once we get to the surface recognition phase between two and five. But the making of the signal and the type of cell being attracted at the pursuit is different between acute inflammation. It's a complement-based signal system that's attracting all of our injured cells. In chronic inflammation, it's a lymphokine-based system that's attracting macrophages. That's why we have two different kinds of cells at the site of attack. You can see that this process of destruction of the cells in the phagocytosome involves many different mediators. I'll just check off a few that I want you to be be aware of. We can activate things through the an oxidative reaction. You can recognize the silver oxide you can produce inside that. Hydrogen peroxide you can produce inside that. And hydrochloride you can produce inside that. Okay. We also have nitrous oxide you can produce inside that. And on this, on the right-hand side, we'll have a variety of oxygen-dependent systems, such as enzymes, and we have lysozyme as an example of enzyme, and there are some other enzymes. The other enzyme that I hope you're aware of is myeloperoxidase. So we have lysozyme and myeloperoxidase, and a variety of different compounds. All of this creates a very hostile environment. Not a single thing, because a single killing agent may not affect every critter. And we have to have a system that can be sort of universal killing. We have a multi-layered oxygen-dependent system. This occurs both in PMN and in macrophages. Now, redness, well, in human pain, are signs of inflammation. And it was initially discovered about 2,000 years ago by a fellow Roman by the name of Gallo. But we have Greek names and Roman names and all kinds of different things. So we get edema, the Greek term, tumor, which is a Latin term. So basically, redness, swelling, heat, and pain are the four signs of inflammation. Now, they didn't know what caused that initially, but they knew it was associated with infection. So that's a tip-off that something's not right. You are infected because you have inflammation. It's important to realize that the inflammation itself is not a bad thing. The inflammation is the alarm system going off that's attracting the right kinds of cells, like pigmented cells and so on, to the area to do the job of killing the invader, to protect you. So inflammation is not bad. If we have inflammation and we don't know what it is, to simply just shut down inflammation without knowing what the problem is creating a problem. It's like turning off an alarm system without realizing where the fire is. If you know the fire is out, okay, we can turn the alarm on. The fire trucks are here, everything is under control, we can turn the alarm on. But if you just have to walk by and the fire trucks have not been called and the building's half on fire, you simply walk in, turn the alarm off, and walk on. That doesn't help the situation. So when we use drugs that are anti-inflammatory, we have to realize that we are making a condition in the patient that's not normal. And we are going to minimize their ability to protect themselves. Anti-inflammatories are commonly used, aspirin for so, for example. There are a variety of anti-inflammatory drugs that have various kinds of effects, but we have to realize that we are manipulating that patient's ability to respond. Acute versus chronic. Acute, we said, was PMN, begins in days, minutes, and we have humoral immunity and antibody. Here we have a little picture. So here we have a splinter. And into this splinter, we have, on the surface of it, we have bacteria. Now, when we have this splinter, we're going to have to break it down into some capillaries. And we have a little paper cut, we have a little blood coming, right? So what's going to come into that area are going to be antibody. And so antibody will bind to that. And we'll just show you the diagrammatic representation of an antibody. And then we have these two long lines and two short lines. That's not around any scale of number. We have this and that. And this together, that's antibody plus antigen. That's the organism of the antigen. That is called an immune complex. An immune complex will activate a complement. Begun a cascade reaction. This is our alarm system. Now, one of the things that's going to do is set up a gradient from this immune complex. I'll just show up by lines further into the remark. And what will happen is the PMN cells will actually sense that inside the blood vessel in here and move through the blood vessel wall to the platelet junction. That's called diapedesis. Okay? Diapedesis. The textbook sometimes called that extravasculation. You see that on this side here? Extravasculation. But I'm going to call it diapedesis. Now, diapedesis is impaired in a diabetic and an alcoholic. In the case of the diabetic, that blood vessel is coated with glucose. Blocks the glycosylation curve. And that blocks this movement out. So that's an impaired step. So that means the pursuit stage of phagocytosis is impaired in the diabetic. It's also impaired in an alcoholic. Just like you can take leather and cross-link it chemically and make cowhide and cross-link it and make shoe leather out of it. The process of tanning a leather is really a cross-linking of proteins. We'll cross-link the proteins on the inside because of the presence of a chronic presence of alcohol. And that will then also impair diabetes. So an alcoholic and a diabetic have difficulty getting these phagocytic cells to the target. That will be both true of both chronic and acute inflammation. You can't get them out of the blood vessel. In this case, the cell can't get out of the PMN. In a chronic inflammation, the cell can't get out of the macrophage. Then we have the movement up this concentration gradient to the target. That's a concentration gradient in acute inflammation that is associated with these complement components. Now, in addition to that, complement component number one is chemotaxis. Chemotaxis is the movement of the concentration gradient. So we have a chemotactic event. We're tracking. It's like dropping perfume in the corner and you can smell it at the upper end, but it's not real strong, but we can sort of figure out where the high concentration is. Exact same kind of process. If I just say cell will go up the concentration gradient, sort of sensing the surface is exercise, sensing that concentration gradient changes. The second thing that we can have coming from this process is mast cell activation. So the mast cells are going to release the histamine. Histamine, we said, is a vasodilator. Now, this is not happening like in type 1 allergy. This is happening right in the tip of your finger. So it's not going to be a systemic release. It's just a local phenomenon. Okay. And so we're going to have that redness occurring there because the blood vessels are dilating and pulling the blood. So it's going to look red there. As it dilates, the blood vessels become more leaky and fluid starts leaving the blood vessel. Swelling. As more and more blood is pulled, it gets hot. Heat. Redness, swelling, heat. And as that fluid pushes against the nerve endings, pain. Even a little paper cut hurts. How do you know that it is even there? How do you know it even hurt? Okay. And it hurts because of the process of inflammation. Okay. Now you have in your mast cell, you have the histamine, they're in the tissue, and I'll bring that my body to science for a moment. I'm just going to break the mast cells. Initially, you can see that I'm sort of a very pale person. Basically, I'm just in the skin there, I'm breaking mast cells. In a very short period of time, mast cells will start releasing histamine. You're going to see the redness reaction there. Probably starts to go there. Trust me, it's happening.
You can see it.
So that's what we're talking about. This is just in the tissue, mast cells in the tissue. Okay. I'm not going to have an anaphylactic shock, but I have released enough to get some redness here. Okay. Redness. Why is it red? Because the blood vessels there are dilated. It's going to get a little warmer there. Redness, swelling, even a little bit of pain. All of that is what we're seeing happening, but this is under a control system because it has occurred because antibody and antigen have come together, create an immune complex, then in turn activates complement, tracks the cells between the taxis, activates mast cells, redness swelling, human pain. Okay? So we now understand what Galen didn't. We understand the mechanism of inflammation. Now, once we get there, we have the ingestion and the digestion. And another thing we should note is that the diabetic has impaired digestion. So it has fewer cells getting there, but the diabetic patient, their cells are not going to be functioning normally, they're not going to digest the organism as well. So it's going to gobble them up and spit some out. The alcoholic will have no trouble with the digestion phase. So I guess a little bit of wine and dinner is okay. So we can line up the genes. The diabetic has problems with diabetes and digestion. So we can start getting a sense of this diabetic patient that has a problem with blood supply, extremities aren't getting the blood that they should get in terms of blood supply, they have anaerobic conditions in the tissue, they're getting anaerobic infections, and when they do have an inflammatory response, it's not working well. You can start seeing the dominoes line up and increase the risk of this patient. This all again was acute. Right? Acute inflammation. Chronic inflammation. Macrophages are the types of cells. Lymphocytes, B cell lymphocytes. Time is 2 to 4 days, to months or years. This is a CMI response. We're not talking to antibodies. We can see lymphocytes. And don't forget, you got the dendritic cell that's going to pop up in the red hat. There's a picture over here. Remember that. And the red hat is the dendritic cell. This dendritic cell is involved as an antigen-presenting cell. Longer hand cells found in various places of the body. You can see them there. They're interdigitating cells in the thymus. They're interstitial in those organs. They're all over the place. And they're involved with antigen presentation. All the information we talk about tomorrow on this slide. Why don't we draw a little picture? Fungal organisms that are not encapsulated. So we have fungal organisms with a capsule, it's going to have an antibody, and it's going to treat inflammation to respond to it. You know, antibody goes past and results in its own. But if it does not have a capsule, then it's going to be something we see on the chronic side. So this could be restorative or fungalizing. You wouldn't get invaded with these, but it also would be a tumor cell. You'd have a chronic inflammation to a tumor cell, which would be either into a splinter, but nonetheless it would be a tumor. And a lot of your anti-tumor would be T cell response. And we also have another target that would be a virally infected cell. Right, the three virus, the virally infected cell. All of these are possible targets for chronic inflammation. Some will be introduced by splinters, for example, tuberculosis would be disturbing, but the tumor would not be introduced by splinter, and nor would be the virally infected cell. But we still have chronic inflammation when we talk. Okay, so this is going to be, we have some blood vessels in here. There's some blood vessels. And in the blood vessel, we're going to break it open a little bit. And we're going to have the first guy on the scene here is going to be a T cell. And the T cell lymphocyte is going to interact with its target, whatever the target is, tuberculosis, or the B-cell, whatever it would be. And that's going to then start by releasing signals for chemotactic factors. Number one, chemotactic factor or macrophage. So the macrophage is in the bloodstream, come out, and the blood concentration is going all the way up to the target. We also have the lymphokine that will activate mast cell activity. And then we're going to get red. Well, pain. 3 to 4 times of inflammation out. Mast cell will begin to triggering. Again, global reaction. And hopefully that will take care of it. And remember, this chronic situation can get big goes for months or years. So if you have a pretty low story that you can buy for months or years, then you have this process for months or years. Put this into some sort of play here. Give you a couple of things. This is one, this is two, this is three. All these three patients have anxiety. We do a spinal tap. We do a cerebral spinal fluid. In patient one, you have glucose concentration in spinal fluid is down. Protein concentration in spinal fluid is up. And we see polymorphic results. We might even might even be antibodies to specific capsule inhibitors. Patient number two, glucose concentration is basically normal, plus minus. Protein concentration is normal, plus minus. We see macrophage, we see lymphocytes. Patient number three, we have glucose slightly elevated. Two, slightly declined. Slightly declined, a little bit drop. The protein was slightly elevated. We see macrophage and we see lymphocytes. One of these patients has a fungal infection, one of these patients has a bacterial infection, one of these patients has a viral infection. What does the number one have? bacteria. Why is the glucose concentration dropping in the bacterial infection? Using it, fermentation.
Oh, that's how it
works. And fermentation. Bring it down, bring it to you. The protein is increasing. Why? What is the protein? Yes. The bacteria is increasing the protein. It is the protein. And of course, BMN is attractive because this is a human inflammatory response. And if we actually wanted to do the testing, we'd find that there's antibodies to bacterium inhibitory, Haemophilus influenzae, Streptococcus pneumoniae, sugar. Okay. Now we have that specific expression to do the actual test. Now let me ask you this. Which patient is going to be more likely to have sequelae from the same bacterium inhibitory? The patient with lots of antibodies or the patient without antibodies? Lots of antibodies that could be infected for a long period of time. It's sort of counterintuitive, people think, if you understand the process, it makes sense. Patient number two. Okay, what's the problem? Is it we have fungal or we have viral? Viral, yes. Okay? And there's no real change in glucose protein levels because it's not really doing any fermenting. It's not really glucose. Living inside itself. And this little bit of protein that it is, but it's not very much, maybe binds on the sort of the inside, but it's not like pre-protein really. But we see the macrophage and lymphocyte there. And there's a hop. I know what that's doing, but the problem is going to come inside the farm. And on patient number three, that's the fungal one, you may see some changes in glucose and protein levels, because we are growing organisms. It's not going to be exactly growing as a bacteria, so the numbers won't change it dramatically, but unlike a bacteria, we're going to see macrophages in humans. Basically, it's like what's happening, okay, last Friday, Saturday, a lot of people were coming to work with weapons, right? It's just an American tradition. Right? So hunting season began on Sunday, but you could go out in the field ahead of time, you know where to go on the morning. So the church is also going to go to the I'm sure some people have checked their guns at the church door and went to church in the morning. But the idea here is that you could go out on an earlier day and you could look for deer. Now, you might look around and look for deer like this, but not deer, but you would do it better if you knew about what the deer did. So you might notice that there could be rubbings on trunks of trees where they're scratching their antlers a little bit, right? To get some of the skin that's on the outer surface of the antler, and they scratch it, so there's rubbings. You might see footprints, right? You might see areas of tall grass that go all the way down where the sun might be more. You might see the fur now. You might see some deer shit running around. And of course, the real thing is pick it up and smell it. I would eat blackberries, I would eat corn. Crazy. Now, you haven't seen deer one, but you know the deer there. Same thing with this data. We haven't seen the organism yet. We haven't done the gram thing. That's coming. But we'll get the results back from the lab first. And we'll know right away the patient's got drops in glucose, increase in protein, we see BMN. We have a bacterial infection. We don't know what it is yet, but we can begin with a broad spectrum antibiotic and maybe intervene in the course of the infection. This is going to be a more serious kind of infection. On the other hand, the patient with lymphocytes, this is maybe fungal or not, we're not really sure. We'll wait a little bit and we'll get some results from the lab. We might do a broad spectrum antibiotic just to cover ourselves, but we'll quickly take them off that once we get the lab results. Agents that might cause a viral meningitis polio might cause it. Okay, that could be an example of a viral, sometimes called aseptic meningitis, meaning it's not the rapidly propagating problem. This would be the septic kind of bacterial, and this would be the aseptic kind. Again, if we have tuberculosis, that would present sort of like between a two and a three. Okay? Tuberculosis would be someplace that we would see macrophage and lymphocytes. It's not going to respond to the broad spectrum agents that we got. So if we have a bacterial agent that's causing this 2 or 3, then we know it's like tuberculosis. And of course, that can all be identified by actually going to stain disease. So this information that we're playing with is something that people should use. It should make some sense of this.
Practical level, we still use the 2 to 4 days, the cellular response, and the
14 days down to 10 to 14 days down to 5 to 7 days for the antibody response. So even though at the cellular level they're acting the same, the adaptation is a little bit different. Next time we'll talk more about the immune system.